data practices to order. The first order of business is to approve the minutes of January 24th. Representative Vogel moves the minutes of January 24th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I didn't bring up the were these the minutes from the Tuesday meeting?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, Madam Chair, there's kind of an elephant in the room, so to speak, about what happened on Tuesday, I think. And I wanted to bring that up as DFL lead on this. It appears that was a bill that came before this committee that wasn't necessarily well thought out. There were some gaping holes in it. And what resulted was some upset individuals, and rightfully so. So I'm hoping that there are ways that we can avoid that in the future, because we have to, you know, in the majority's interest, you need to move bills through, and we couldn't move the next bill through, which is today's bill on the agenda, which, in my opinion, isn't well thought either, and has some gaping holes in it. But it is my hope in the future, Madam Chair, that we can avoid that. And I want to be able to work with you to find out how we can correctly manage that so that we can get the business the committee done. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Lesch. There were no surprises to me in what went on Tuesday. And I've talked to several people that were in support of that bill. I think we've gotten many members in this committee have received many members that emails that were in support of that bill, and sometimes we do controversial things here, and it's just the nature of what we do and what we're elected to do. So, but I appreciate your comments, Representative Lesch. Representative Lunan, House File 251. Would you like to move your bill? And the next stop for this would be to be re-referred to Public Safety and Security and Policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I ask that we move House File 251.
Okay. Very good. The file's been moved to your bill.
First of all, thank you for hearing the bill. This bill will repeal Statute 169.685, which is basically a gag order on admitting in evidence in a civil case whether or not the plaintiff was wearing their seatbelt at the time of a car accident. This gag order was enacted back in the time when the liability laws of the land were quite different. There are two different ways that states impose liability or negligence, contributory and comparative. And in contributory, which we were in the past, if there was a car accident involving more than one vehicle, you either collected all of your damages or none of your damages. If you in any way contributed to that injury occurring, you could collect nothing. They put the gag order in place, rightfully so, because if there was a car accident and you ran into me and I wasn't wearing my seatbelt, and even though you were the cause of the accident, I would be able to collect nothing, because the fact that I did the negligent act, I made the decision to not have my seatbelt on, would preclude me from collecting anything at all, and it just seemed like that was unreasonable and a harsh threshold. Minnesota has since switched to a comparative negligence. In a comparative negligence, every time there's an accident, all parties involved get assigned, if they have it coming, a certain percentage of the negligence, with the total being 100%. Yeah, again, if there's a car accident and you run into me and I sue for my injury, what I can collect is reduced by the percentage of negligence that I have in causing my level of injury or damage. When we talk about an accident or an event or occurrence, there are two components to consider. There is the frequency or likelihood of an accident or event to occur, and then there is the severity or the dollar amount. Seatbelt usage, I can't find any data that has anything to do with it causing an accident, increasing the chance of an accident occurring. You know, something like having your dog in your car in your lap, that would be a factor that would. Wearing your seatbelts, I couldn't find any data on it. However, there is plenty of evidence that shows that failing to wear your seatbelt in cases does increase the level of injury you sustain. So the questions that come into play is that if I go through and make the decision to not wear my seatbelt, and seatbelt usage is very high, but if I decide to not wear my seatbelt and I am injured in a car accident, who should be held accountable? Who should be paying for that negligent act on my part? What this bill does is it doesn't make that decision. What it does is it allows the evidence of wearing seatbelts or not to be available to the jury to consider when factoring out when assigning comparative negligence. Today, a jury is allowed to know in a car accident whether you were late for work. Was that a factor in how you were driving? They're allowed to know if you were eating or you were drinking coffee in your car. That's a factor in how you drive, can or can be, cannot be a factor in how you drive. They are not allowed to know whether or not you had your seatbelt on. What I'm asking in this bill is to repeal the gag order and allow the jury to make civil decisions based on all of the data. And I stand for questions.
Representative Hill, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Lunin, it is also a gag order that you cannot tell the jury whether or not there is insurance as part of the crash. Would you be open to an amendment to eliminate that gag rule as well so that the jury would get to hear all of the data?
I would not, and here's why. Because whether or not I have insurance has absolutely no bearing on how injured I am. It has absolutely no bearing on increasing or decreasing that car accident occurring. It does make available the assets that would be available to indemnify the victim, and I follow with you there. But what the jury is deciding is what is the percentage of negligence you have in the car accident to what I have in the car accident. So that provision, I would oppose that. It doesn't pertain.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say you can't make the argument that you want the jury to have all of the information if, again, you want to keep one gag order and eliminate the other.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. That's a good point. I want the jury to have all of the evidence that pertains.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question, Representative Lunin. Are you proposing that the jury hear evidence of seatbelt use in a case in chief?
Excuse me?
Representative Lunin.
I didn't hear the question.
I'll repeat the question, Madam Chair. Representative Lunin, are you proposing that the jury hear evidence of seatbelt use in the case in chief?
Representative Lunin.
I don't understand the question. What do you mean in chief? I don't understand the question.
You described that there are two levels. There's the likelihood of an accident happening, and then there's the damages portion.
The severity, correct.
Correct? Okay. So I'm asking if you think the jury should hear evidence of seatbelt use when they're considering whether there was fault.
Representative Lunin.
Whether there was fault?
Correct.
I do not think, again, I have not found any evidence that shows that seatbelts are a factor in the likelihood of whether or not I am at fault or not. It's a factor in what percentage of negligence I have. I guess my answer would, the situation I'm thinking of right now is that if there's evidence that shows that if I had had my seatbelt on, I wouldn't have been injured at all, and I didn't have my seatbelt on and was injured, then that should be admissible.
Representative,
I don't know if that answers your question.
He's using some lawyer talk up.
Well, that's why I pared it down to the fault, Madam Chair. I
appreciate that.
Fault versus damages portion. I suspect, based on your answer, that this bill does something that maybe you don't intend to do. Because you said that it's not relevant as to whether an accident occurred of whether a person was wearing a seatbelt. A seatbelt isn't a giant magnet that draws Mack trucks toward my
I'm aware, field. Representative.
Okay, right. So you agree with that, which is why I have some current concerns, but maybe, Madam Chair, we can go to the testifiers who are better able to explain whether that is or is not the case.
Representative Lunin, do you have any other comments about your bill?
I do not. I do have testifiers.
Okay, very good. The first testifier I have on the list is Paul Godfrey with the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Paul Godfrey. I am a member of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. And I'm here in support of the bill because our situation in our courts is that everybody's responsible for their own actions, and we're all required to act reasonably. If we don't act reasonably, we're going to be held responsible for that, and that's whether you're a plaintiff or a defendant in a lawsuit. So I think that's true in every case except for this one, where if you're wearing a seatbelt and that contributes to your injury, the jury is not allowed to hear about it because of the gag order. So I think it is something the jury should hear about. And is it, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh?
Mm-hmm. I lost my table tent, so...
What?
Oh, you've been lost.
No, I was...
It is Representative Lesh.
Representative Lesh. In answer to the question, I think this goes, and it is hard to see your name tags, that it goes more to apportionment of damages. And this is something that happens quite common in personal injury lawsuits where someone has a prior accident or a subsequent accident, and the fault is apportioned for the accident, and then the jury is also asked to apportion responsibility for the injury. And this, in my view, this repealing this gag order would do more to go to apportionment of damages than to fault.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Godfrey. I noticed three words in your response, which was goes more to. Does that mean, are you suggesting the jury would not hear about seatbelt use when they were determining fault, or they would under this language?
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, Representative Lutz, I do think they could hear about it. I think it would be more frequently applied to apportionment of damages. I suppose there is a situation where someone not wearing a seatbelt could have contributed to the happening of the accident, but I don't see that as occurring too often.
Well,
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, there are many states that have different variations on this, Mr. Godfrey. There are many states that will make sure that it's only for the damages portion. But as I understand it, what you're proposing, and you just stated that the jury could hear about it. Now, you're a lawyer. You've had trial before juries, I'm sure, as have I. And I know darn well, as an attorney, if there's certain evidence that I can get in to make the other side look bad, I'm going to do it. So, and you will too. So the fact that they weren't wearing a seatbelt when you've got some finger-wagging school marms up in the jury box, you know absolutely what that will do when they determine whether or not someone's at fault. So that is a major concern of mine, because what that's doing is exactly what Representative Lunan says he doesn't want to do.
Mr. Godfrey?
Madam Chair, Representative Lutz, I suppose that's a possibility. I don't see that as something that should prevent the bill from being passed.
Representative Lesh?
Well, Madam Chair, and Mr. Godfrey, that's absolutely something that should prevent the bill from being passed, because it's what the author says he doesn't want to accomplish, and it's what you're accomplishing. And by saying, well, it's probably not going to happen, that's not how we pass bills around here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lunan.
I don't know what you're contending that I'm saying I want to prevent, but I do believe there are instances where seatbelt usage could be a contributing factor, good or bad, as to whether or not a loss occurred. If a party contends that I'm driving a car and I was reaching for something on the floor or whatever, but the police report shows I had my seatbelt on, obviously that did not happen. In most cases, the seatbelt usage would affect what percent of negligence I have. But I can imagine cases where seatbelt usage may be a contributing factor on whether or not I was negligent in the accident, depending on what was going on inside the car.
What? Representative Lesh, you have the floor, sir.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lunan, I don't know if this is an alternative fact in order to get your bill passed, but that doesn't make any sense. There are four parts of negligence: duty, breach, causation, damages. Okay, the first two are negligence per se, if you can establish those. The last two causation and damages, you have to have those in order to recover. And the insurance lawyers know, the insurance company lawyers know that very well. They're two different things. What you're trying to do is slip the damages piece into the causation piece in order to get a jury to look negatively upon the other party. You should have been wearing your seatbelt and you didn't. We're going to say, yeah, it was kind of your fault. That's that giant magnet that I'm talking about, that not wearing a seatbelt suddenly redirects trucks at your vehicle, which makes it your fault for the accident. You said you don't want to do that, and that's what happens. I'm not sure if you really understand this bill, Representative Luna. It has some major holes in it because of that very fact.
Representative Dean, you are next on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Luna, it's just a simple question. You know, wearing a seatbelt or not wearing a seatbelt really doesn't cause accidents. And what you're talking about is damage. I'm curious why there isn't anything about driving your car with the tires underinflated. Because that's more likely to cause an accident than a seatbelt issue. And I'm curious why you don't have this as part of this bill.
Representative Lunin.
Well, I would invite the representative to propose that in future legislature. I'm here to solve this problem, to improve the situation, and allow juries to base their civil decisions on all of the data that pertains to the factors or the outcomes of the occurrence.
Okay. Representative Dean, did you? Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to take you through a crash scenario. You're driving the vehicle. Your child's in the back seat. Supposed to be in a safety seat. The safety seat isn't quite installed correctly, as we know. Many parents don't know quite how to install those safety seats. A crash occurs. A drunk driver hits you. Your child is injured. Currently, they would not be able to bring that into the court on whether or not you specifically had that seat belt done correctly. Now, under this proposal, you would, and now the parent would be more liable or responsible than the drunk driver that hit you. That's going to be the outcome. Then when you go to sue to recover some kind of help for your child who has been injured, your insurance company can choose not to settle the case and make you, as the parent, be sued by your child. And then that jury doesn't get to hear whether or not you have insurance. And the jury gets to go, why is this child suing their parent for their injury? So you are creating a situation where the drunk driver, who is completely at fault, is going to be less liable, is going to be less liable for your damages because the parent may or may not have installed that car seat correctly. I think that's a perverted outcome of this bill, and I want you to know that that is a consequence of what you have here, and I don't know that that's what you intend to do.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. First of all, the case that you state would be more likely to be a grandparent that didn't have the chair installed correctly. The claim that I've seen out in the insurance world, that's where there was a problem with that, and I agree that that's an issue. But in comparative negligence, all parties that contribute to the loss occurring are handed that degree of negligence. I'm not a lawyer. I believe there's liability factors where the operator of the vehicle, or there are people, I don't know if it's strict and absolute liability, I'm not exactly what the term is, where the person who installs that car seat, whether it's the parent or the grandparent, do have an obligation to make sure that that's installed correctly. So the case you're giving, yes, could in fact happen. And and in fact does happen. Right now, that the drivers of the car, even though they weren't primarily at fault, are assigned a degree of the negligence for the injuries of the passengers in the car.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if it's already happening, you just want to make it happen more? That's what this bill does.
Representative Lunin.
Madam Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, when those decisions are made, as I have stated three times now, I want those decisions to be based on all of the pertinent data, not just most of it.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Representative Lunin, you aren't, because you don't let the jury hear whether or not they have insurance. So you're picking and choosing which facts the juries are going to hear. We at the legislature are deciding that we are going to skew the outcome in favor of insurance companies, and that's what this bill does. This bill enriches the insurance company so they don't have to pay.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Lunin.
I think in a civil action, in a car accident, I don't think a third party sues the carrier. I think they actually sue the at-fault party. The insurance contract requires that the insurance company come in and pay for damages legally owed. So it's not a direct action. To the insurance company, will it affect insurance claim pays out? Yes, it will. Again, though, whether I have insurance or not had no bearing on how hurt I got, had no bearing on how negligent I was. What it does have a bearing on is what assets are available to indemnify the victims, the plaintiffs.
Mr. Godfrey, did you have any further comments?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, under the scenario you described, I think you concluded that the drunk driver would get out of it. I don't think that would be true. I think the jury would be asked to apportion liability between the drunk driver and whoever installed the car seat. And I guess that would be fact-dependent on how the jury would apportion the negligence between those two actors.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lunin testified that if you were at fault and if no injury would have happened if you would have been wearing your seatbelt, the jury gets to hear that. Well, I just acknowledged that the car seat was installed correctly because we know a lot of people install car seats incorrectly. We have a whole training that goes on here, and you can go to the police department and get law enforcement to help you install your car seat because we know how that happens all the time. And what you're saying to me is if the drunk driver can prove that that child would not have been hurt had that car seat been installed correctly, Representative Lunin testified that then they would not be responsible.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Mr. Godfrey, can you tell me why is evidence of having purchased insurance not admissible in a proceeding like this?
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, it's my belief that that goes to something that's not related to the fault for the accident. And it also is my belief that not everybody has the same level of insurance. So if just by disclosing that you have insurance, you're not letting people know on the jury whether you have a $30,000 minimum policy or a $3 million umbrella.
Madam Chair, thank you. But Mr. Godfrey, certainly whether or not you're going to be covered for a risk that you take would have a bearing on your propensity to take that risk. Isn't that true?
I would just, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I would disagree with that.
Madam Chair, you disagree. If I've got backup going into a situation, you're saying that that would have no bearing upon whether or not I make the decision to take that leap. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't believe that people take actions based upon how much insurance they have.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Godfrey, as an attorney, you know well we have all kinds of rules of evidence that determine whether or not something can go in and whether or not something can't go in. Insurance, when this entire debate came up, insurance started coming in, lawyers absolutely intended to get evidence of that insurance in for the very reason that I stated. But as a matter of public policy, we decided not to do that, and also because insurance companies don't want people to know the limits of the insurance, because that's the damage award that the juries will give every time. Okay? But the fact is, it absolutely does have bearing, and for very good reason. And that's the same reason of why we don't allow evidence of the seatbelt use to go in. I don't have any more questions after that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Godfrey, did you have any?
Madam Chair, nothing
further. I have a question.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Godfrey, you're a defense attorney, so you represent insurance companies and probably some drunken drivers and distracted drivers. Is that a correct statement?
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I am an insurance defense lawyer, yes.
Okay.
And I represent all kinds of people.
Okay, fair enough. So,
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As an attorney representing the insurance interest, would you say it's a fair statement that they stand to benefit financially from this legislation substantially?
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I don't know if substantially, could this affect damages awards? The answer is yes.
Okay.
Mr. Carlson, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Godfrey, you're in the business. What are the current statistics in terms of how many people are currently wearing their seatbelt?
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I don't have that information at my fingertips.
Chair. Really? I'll tell you. I have it right here. 94%. So Would you say that's pretty good in terms of what we've done in terms of public information, in terms of informing folks in terms of the benefits of wearing a seatbelt?
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I would say that's very good.
That's very good.
And I would also say that this might help increase that.
Okay, so we're going to go.
Representative Powell.
Okay. We're going to go from 94% up to, what are we going to go up to? 95%? 96%?
Is that a
question
to the
Representative Carlson? I don't know what the improvement, but my feeling is this might help, and if it does help, I think that's a good thing. Any way we could push that number higher, I think would be an improvement.
Representative Carlson?
I'm done. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Godfrey, I'm really confused because about 3 minutes ago you said that risk does not impact behavior, as well as when Representative Lesworth was asking you about size of policies and behaviors and things like that. And now you say that this is going to enhance behavior because of the risk of individuals that are going to have as far as their exposure. So I'm really confused. Which is it? Does risk, you know, influence behavior, or does it not influence behavior? If you could just clarify that, yes or no would be great.
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I believe what I stated in answer to the previous question is that I don't believe people take actions based upon how much coverage they have.
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, I'd have to look at the transcript, but I don't think those were your exact words. Thank you.
If that's not what I said, that's what I meant.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Godfrey. Any further questions for this testifier? Thank you, Mr. Godfrey. The next testifier, Bob Johnson.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I yield first to John Houselot and Ms. Abadi before me, and I'll have just a 30
sure.
second half.
Sure. So, John Houselot, President of the Minnesota Trucking Association. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am John Houselot, President of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and I am here to testify today in support of the bill before you, the so-called seatbelt gag rule. We do believe that repealing this law will further encourage Minnesotans to take their own safety into account while driving and make our roadways safer. The legislature passed the seatbelt gag rule in 1963, prohibiting evidence of whether a motorist was wearing their seatbelt during an accident from being admitted in court of law. And there really were several justifications at that time. First, seatbelts were not yet even mandatory in motor vehicles, and there was no broad consensus that wearing them made people safer. Second, as was already stated, Minnesota used the principle of contributory negligence in evaluating a plaintiff's claim. If a jury found a plaintiff even 1% at fault for their accident, they were completely barred from recovering damages. The gag rule offered plaintiffs some procedural protection by removing the question of seatbelt use entirely. Well, over 50 years later, things have changed. Seatbelts are mandatory in vehicles. And, as we've heard conversations, statistics clearly demonstrate that seatbelts promote safety and save lives. Furthermore, Minnesota no longer follows the rule of contributory negligence. We replace it with comparative fault, which allows a plaintiff's recovery to be reduced proportionately to their fault rather than barring them from recovery altogether. And finally, we've made failure to wear your seatbelt a primary traffic offense. So we ask the question, why have one law on the books criminalizing non-use of seatbelts and another that removes the mere fact of seatbelt use from the legal process altogether? Simply put, the original justifications for passing the seatbelt gag rule no longer apply. We believe repealing it will encourage all Minnesotans to wear their seatbelt and take responsibility for their own safety. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Houselot, is it true that you're aware of we have a law on the books that prevents you from beating your wife, right?
Mr. Houselot.
Prevents a person from beating a spouse. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Houselot, is that evidence admissible in a proceeding to determine comparative fault in a traffic accident?
Mr. Houselot.
Is which evidence? I'm sorry.
Evidence that you were convicted of domestic assault, Madam Chair, Mr. Houselot, admissible to determine your fault in a proceeding for a traffic accident?
Mr. House-Lawton.
Yeah, Representative Lesh, I'm not an attorney, so I honestly don't know the answer.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, Mr. House-Lawton, I can tell you no, it's not. But my question to you is, why have one law on the books that prohibits a certain act that is not permitted to determine whether another action under law was violated? That was your question. And the reason I'm going to give you the answer is because one has no bearing on the other. Just like me wearing a seatbelt is supposedly, at least according to the author, not a giant magnet that draws one of your trucks toward my minivan full of a family full of six that's going to cause the actual damage. No more questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hazan. And we'll move on to Ms. Cedar Abadi with Advantage Management Corporation. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of repeal of Minnesota's seatbelt gag rule. My name is Cedar Abadi, and I'm testifying today on behalf of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. As you've already heard, the public policy basis underlying Minnesota's seatbelt gag rule has substantially evaporated. National seatbelt usage is at about 87%, and as pointed out by Representative Carlson, Minnesota exceeds that, buckling up at about a rate of 94%. That is a happy consequence that has come about in no small part due to the consistent messaging originating in the House and the Senate, and as well as the consistent education and enforcement occurring at by local and state agencies. Against the backdrop of that consistent messaging, we have a person who's called to jury duty, a Minnesotan sitting in a jury box. That Minnesotan has been the intended target and recipient of this consistent messaging for decades. They likely, and in fact, given the statistics, almost certainly buckled up on their way to the courthouse that day, taking into account the foreseeability of motor vehicle accidents on American roadways, almost 10 million happen a year. And they understand that buckling up, that simple and effective safety action that takes seconds, will substantially reduce their likelihood of suffering severe personal injury in the case of that foreseeable accident. So that juror sitting in that box is not permitted to take into account in any respect, whether it be at the liability portion or the damages portion of a trial. They're not allowed to take into account whether the injured plaintiff took that same action in the same foreseeability of a motor vehicle accident that occurred to them. That is an incongruous result at best. Simply put, the fact is continuing consistent messaging on seatbelt use would require the consideration of non-use evidence at trial. The alternative, the gag rule that we have today, is counter to Minnesota practice and policy and results in the illogical and unfair result of allowing an unbelted occupant to shift the burden to be rewarded and shift the burden of their non-use to another party. For these reasons, we would hope that you would consider supporting this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Abadi. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abadi, why do you want evidence of use to be permitted when the jury is considering fault? Not damages, but fault.
Ms. Abadi.
Madam Chair, Representative. This has been a topic, and my thought was this would be something that would be decided at the motion in limine phase. A good defense attorney and a good plaintiff's attorney would argue about what phase of a trial this sort of thing would be permitted in. I know that's not a part of the bill, but there's a gag rule superimposed over the admissibility of evidence under the normal relevance rules, right? We have a gag rule that prevents it. Removing that gag rule would allow the normal rules of weighing the admissibility and relevance of evidence to come back into play, would it not?
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Lesh,
we have all kinds of quote-unquote gag rules on the statutes in the state of Minnesota, and for good reason, things that we do not permit to be subject to the whims of any particular trial court in any district of this state for very solid policy reasons. So what you're saying is, well, I don't know, maybe it shouldn't, but let's just leave it up to a trial court to decide. Well, no, we don't do that for a very solid reason. And your representation here of the position of the insurance industry is a gigantic windfall to the insurance industry. Huge. And Mr. Johnson knows that when he comes forward, I'm just giving him a little warno, military we call it a warning order. He knows because I ask him this every time. How much will that reduce insurance premiums in the state of Minnesota? How much? So that's just my little warno, but you knew that already, Mr. Johnson. So, but Ms. Abadie, how much do you think? Do you have any sense? Do you think it would reduce insurance premiums in the state of Minnesota if we were to change this?
Ms. Abadie.
Chair, Representative, I'm afraid I don't have an opinion on that. I would be unqualified to offer that financial assessment. What I will say is one of the common element that you indicated underlies the many gag rules that Minnesota has is sound public policy. And what you've heard today and what you'll continue to hear and what is borne up by the facts and statistics is that public policy has, for very happy reasons, evaporated. There is no public policy support for the seatbelt gag rule in Minnesota today.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abadie, did you say no public support or no public reason? I couldn't hear what you said.
I hope, Ms. Abadie.
Sorry. Chair, Representative, I hope what I said was no public policy reason supporting. I may not have said that, but that's what I meant.
Okay, well.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, Ms. Abadie, do you think that use of a seatbelt has bearing on fault itself?
Ms. Abadie.
Chair, Representative, I do not.
Okay, well,
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, then there's a pretty solid logical reason remaining for us not to pass this bill. No further questions, Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, thank you. That's all right, Madam Chair. It's early. So I'm not sure if you're the person to ask this question, so if you're not, I'll ask the next testifier. But tell me the scope of the issue. How many cases are tried in Minnesota where this gag rule has come into play, and what are the damages that are believed to be unfairly attributed to the insurance company that we believe, if we change this law, should be attributable to the person who failed to buckle up?
Ms. Abadie. Chair, Representative, I'm afraid that the scope of that question is beyond my knowledge.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you were speaking about other states. Do you have any information about other states and the impact changing this rule has had on other states and lawsuits?
Ms. Abadie.
Chair, Representative, no, I don't.
Ms. Hillstrom. Representative Hillstrom.
That's okay. Madam Chair, I will ask the next testifier that question as well.
Thank you. Any other questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you. Ms. Abadie. Mr. Johnson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
I will. Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'm also the board chair of the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. And just a couple of points, and I won't repeat anything that's been said so far. But a couple of follow-ups. Representative Carlson, you had cited the 94% number of compliance rate. We have other statistics that come from the Department of Public Safety that follow up, I think, answer some more specifics of what you asked. While that's the percentage, more than 50% of traffic fatalities in Minnesota involve victims who are not wearing seatbelts. So when you dig into the numbers, there is a high percentage compliance rate, but the fact of the matter is that the fatalities and serious injuries, there's a large percentage concentration of Minnesotans who are not wearing their seatbelt. So just follow-up information that I think is relevant on the point you were making. But from the state statistics, they quantify that, and I don't have the book here, but we can get the book for you and the committee. That's more than $150 million a year in terms of the cost to the state. You know, however that comes into in terms of impacting the cost. So those statistics on that. Madam Chair, then the other, just a couple of quick points. I know other folks want to ask questions, and I'll address Representative Lesh's question maybe at the end of what I indicate what I'm going to say. I do want to just indicate other groups, and there's a growing list of groups that support this legislation. The Minnesota Medical Association supports it. The ER Physicians of Minnesota support this. The ambulance service providers of Minnesota support this legislation. The Minnesota Safety Council supports this legislation. So there are a number of groups who authorized me to give their names that are not here to testify, but they're part of the broadening group that supports this bill. And last two points. One is that Representative Hillstrom, you had asked, and while this is an area of law that there's a lot of nuance in what states do, so I don't have copies of the state statutes and the case law that's put their state into a different position than Minnesota's. In other words, evidence is introduced for the jury to consider this, and so we're not plowing new ground that's not done in other states. New York, California, New Jersey, Florida, Arizona, Kentucky, North Dakota, Alaska, there are a number of states. Now, again, I'm not saying it's the same as this bill, but it's absolutely, as they have either statutorily or in their case law permitted the evidence of the non-use of a seatbelt for a plaintiff who is suing for injury. So we can follow up to whatever extent you'd like to see these state laws, these state cases. And again, they're nuanced, so I'm not saying it's the same because that wouldn't be accurate. But it is accurate to say that that happens in the states that I mentioned, that does happen. And lastly, and I'll just start it, and there'll probably be some follow-up, but specifically to address, because they do represent property casualty insurers, and this is not a windfall bill for property casualty insurers at all. This has got nothing to do with money for property casualty insurers. The rates that you all pay in your constituents, they don't leap forward guessing what might happen. They look at the past experience in terms of the losses, the claims paid in this state to Minnesotans, and then they, using that loss data, they compile the rates that have to be filed with our Commerce Department, and they're subject to Commissioner Rothman's scrutiny and review. And if those rates don't meet the statutory standards, that they can't be excessive, they can't be inadequate, and they can't be unfairly discriminatory. There's a lot more detail behind it, but those are the three benchmarks. And if they fail that, then they're not going to be able to be used, period. So at least just a little background on that. So there is no number to give. The point of the matter is that if this bill is passed into law, and depending on what it does in terms of jury verdicts and the amounts of money awarded, then those are the statistics, whatever that might be. I'm not here to say, because nobody can say, because we're talking about putting evidence before a jury. They're going to consider that not having a seatbelt when they do this determination of what should a plaintiff recover. So there is no answer to the question. It's not ducking it. There's no answer to that question. We will see what it does, and depending on the impact, then that impact, I can assure you, will work its way immediately into the rates that consumers pay for auto insurance. So is it relevant to it? It's relevant to it, but it's not a windfall. This isn't saving money for auto insurers. It doesn't do that. It simply doesn't do that. So you can say that, but it doesn't do that. That's not how the system works. That's not how it's going to work. And it's going to work the way that I describe it in terms of what its impact will be affecting rates depending on what it does. If it doesn't decrease what the claim payments are to Minnesotans, then it's not going to have an impact. If it does, it could, but it would be a factor amongst a multitude of factors that go into what a rate is. We're paying for auto policies, they're paying for these liability costs in cases, they're paying for personal injury protection and wage loss and rehab benefits. There's a whole lot of costs that are loaded into that. So at least I'll start that, Representative Lesh, with the response to your question. And that concludes my comments, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Johnson, suggesting that this legislation is going to increase seatbelt usage, I believe, is just absolute folly. And as we've heard from other testifiers, there's just
no evidence has been provided to indicate that seatbelt usage causes car accidents. So, again, speaks to why we are even having this conversation today. In all due respect, I do believe that this is, as we saw from the testifiers today in representation of the insurance industry, that there is financial gain to be made on behalf of insurance companies to the disservice of Minnesotans. So I respectfully disagree with many of the comments you made today.
I have a question here, and then I'll get to the other two folks here that are on the list. Since we're talking about whether or not this would benefit the insurance companies, what would this do? Walk me through a plaintiff's case when they bring a case. How are they compensated? How are the plaintiff's lawyers compensated in an issue in a case like this? Do they get a percentage of the award? And would you expect that to go up or down under this new law?
Madam Chairman, on comparative negligence, what happens is there's always, the analogy I use is a pie of 100%. And if some person's percent of negligence is increased, someone else's is decreased, and vice versa. And the plaintiff, first of all, the action isn't against an insurance company. The action is against the other individuals. The insurance contract, if it is involved, and in almost 15% of the drivers out there right now do not have insurance. And so if you get hit by one of them, that's who actually will be paying out of pocket. What happens is that the jury decides what your loss is or your injury is, and then goes through and just says, okay, well, that gets decreased by the percentage of negligence you are assigned. So for simple numbers, if your loss is considered to be $100,000 and you are assigned 20% negligence and 80% to the other driver, then you are only going to be able to collect 80% of your loss.
And so I'm assuming that your attorney's fees are based on what award you get, if any.
Yes, typically, but not always. That's a contract between the plaintiff attorney and the victim, but there would be a relationship there which would obviously cause some consternation in this gag order getting repealed.
Mr. Johnson?
I think what you're asking is that how the plaintiff lawyer is compensated if they're representing an injured. I think it's fair to describe
correct.
It. They operate on a contingency fee, which is going to be a percentage of the recovery. It's $1 million recovery, then it's a percentage of that. It's $50,000, then that's probably close to that similar percentage. But I don't represent plaintiff lawyers, so I'm not here to tell you exactly what that is. There's others probably coming up who can give you more details, but they operate on a contingent fee in a personal injury case, an automobile accident. So if it's a larger damage award, there's going to be more compensation. It shrinks down, then the attorney's fee will shrink down accordingly.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I asked this question of the last testifier, and I hope that you have the answers that I'm looking for. Can you tell me about the lawsuits that are currently happening? How many are there in Minnesota? What are the damages that are paid, and how many of them relate to seatbelt or non-seatbelt use?
Yeah, Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Johnson.
Representative Hillstrom, I don't have court statistics. I don't have that here today, so I can't answer your question about the numbers and the breakdowns, and I don't even know that there's a compilation of some of those jury verdict. I don't even know if that's available. But I think surely the number of civil suits filed, and there's some court statistics, we wouldn't be the keepers of that. But you well know there are organizations that are the keeper of those statistics that I'm certain that we could get for you or the committee.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, usually someone who is advocating on behalf of a law change has a scope of the problem, of why it's a problem and what the cost is to the folks who want to change it. So that is why I asked you that question. The next question that I have is you testified that there was a list of people who are supporting the change in the proposal. Can you tell me if ALEC is on that list? Because this is one of the proposals that has come out of ALEC. So can you tell me if ALEC is on the list of people who are supporting this change?
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know anybody at ALEC. I haven't talked to anybody at ALEC. So, to the best of my knowledge, if they're supporting it, they haven't told any of us in Minnesota.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just happens to be one of the proposals on their website and in their boot camp proposals in the past. And then the final question that I have is the folks who are proposing this change, who are supporting it and part of this lawsuit reform, if they believe that gag rules should not be under in Minnesota law, would they also support removing the gag rule that says you cannot tell the jury whether or not there is insurance. And if you don't support that particular gag rule being repealed, why not?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know that I have anything different to add than what's been said, because that issue's got nothing to do with this issue. And the fact that or not whether or not somebody's carrying insurance isn't relevant in terms of their behavior and their injuries that they're suing for. I haven't asked any of the other board members of Minnesotans for Loss Reform, I guess specifically on your question about the insurance issue, so I cannot answer that. For me, we disagree with that, and that's probably not a surprise. So I'm not going to speculate on what other interest groups, if they have an opinion on that, because we haven't talked about it.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this will be my last question. So in the event that, take my drunk driving scenario that I talked about a bit ago, where a drunk driver hits a car, right? You're driving, your driver is in the back, the seatbelt is, the car seat is incorrectly installed, as we know many Minnesotans do. We spend a lot of money educating parents on how to install seatbelts. So in the event, a parent has, or grandparent has inadvertently installed the car seat incorrectly, but there is a finding that that child would not have been injured had the car seat been installed properly, if the parent doesn't have insurance, or maybe the parent is in poverty, isn't it the state then that steps in and covers the expenses for uninsured folks, or who pays that bill?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I want to make sure I'm kind of tracking through your facts that you're asking. I guess at the end, you're ending if there is somebody that's uncompensated,
mm-hmm.
is if that's the question, then who pays for uncompensated damages?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the event the child still needs care, serious care, and the insurance company of the person, the drunk driver, does not have to pay the bill, and the parents don't have the ability to pay it, who's going to pay the bill to take care of that child? The state. That's the answer.
Well, you, that's not the question.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, are any of your insurance company members of your organization, are any of them a nonprofit?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, no.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, all other, say there are a lot of factors that go into a lawsuit. A lot of things happen in court. Evidence comes in. People make decisions. The jury pool you get could be a huge factor in which way things go. But let's say all things being equal, all other things being equal, if we pass this bill, will your insurance company's members have a better chance of winning in court, or a worse chance of winning in court?
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I don't believe this bill impacts this issue of a better chance or a worse chance. What this bill impacts is what evidence the jury hears in terms of a plaintiff recovering damages. So it's not a winning or losing. It's that is a factor in what that recovery might be. If it may change it, it may not change it. I don't know that. That's why juries are given that. That's their task, is to look at that evidence that's before them. So I don't think your question fits the bill, because the answer is it's not a winning or losing. It's impacting what that determination is a fault and what can be recovered.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that, Mr. Johnson. You gave it the old college try on that one, and I get that. But everyone here around the table knows the answer to that question. It's the reason you're here. It's the reason you are in front of us. It's the reason why person representing Minnesotans against lawsuit reform or for lawsuit reform is counsel for a trucking company. That's why the trucking company is here. Everything about this bill shows incentive. And as I'm hearing the testimony about this bill, I'm thinking about all of the things that would be inadmissible in court if we were hearing this in court. I would not be able to impeach the testimony of a person who came up saying she's here, Minnesota's for lawsuit reform, by saying you have a financial incentive because you're a lawyer for Dart Trucking. I wouldn't be able to say that in court, okay, because it's specifically what's there. I wouldn't be able to say this is an ALEC bill. This is part of a group of bills that is simply aimed at enriching the insurance companies. I probably wouldn't be able to ask directly how much money did insurance companies give the GOP caucus in order to ram through a bill that's going to be bad for Minnesotans and be bad for victims of drunk drivers, right? I probably wouldn't be able to ask that question. But the thing is, here we can ask that. Now, there's very good reasons why in court you're not allowed to ask those questions. But thankfully, here we can ask them because it exposes the fact that this bill is simply a windfall to insurance companies. It will enrich you. It will help you win for the same reasons that you question the integrity of plaintiff's lawyers who are representing the victims of those drunk drivers. That same reasoning goes against you, Mr. Johnson, and your entire industry, because yes, when your lawyers win, you guys get paid, because as you stated, there's not a single member of yours that's nonprofit. You're all for-profit, and it's why you're here supporting this bill. And it's the only reason why you're supporting it.
Representative Lesh, do you know any plaintiff's lawyers that are nonprofit?
I don't think that's permissible under the rules, Madam Chair.
Well, I'm trying to make a point here. I'm trying to make a point here that they're, for what you said about the insurance folks giving money to the Republican caucus, the same thing could be said of the trial lawyers giving money to the Democrat caucus. And so, you know what? We're here. This is kind of a matter of commerce. And there's money to be made on both sides of this issue, or money to be made or lost on both sides of this issue. We're trying to get to the point of whether this is the right thing to do or not, to have people take some sort of responsibility for wearing a seatbelt or not in the outcomes of their damages. Representative Dean, you have the next question?
Two quick questions.
Okay. And then we're going to go on to, we have one last testifier, and we need to get to that, because if we don't get to this other bill today, we will come back tonight after session. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple quick questions. My understanding is when we purchase automobile coverage in the state of Minnesota, we actually cover uninsured motorists. And you stated earlier that the claim would be against the individual driver who was uninsured. Who pays in the event that it's not recoverable from that individual? Wouldn't it be the insurance company? Representative Lunin.
Okay, Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Representative Dean. What ends up happening is, you are right, if it is not collectible from the individual, the uninsured motorist coverage would pay. But an important distinction is that the driver, the at-fault driver, first has their finances at risk for that. They're responsible for their percentage of the negligence.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I'll just sort of make a statement that generally people that drive without insurance tend to drive without insurance because they can't afford it. So the thought that something is really recoverable from them, I think, is a little bit questionable as far as reasoning, but I'll let that go. Mr. Johnson, you stated that you don't know anybody at ALEC, and I'm looking at a list, and I believe that Representative Garofalo is the state chair of ALEC. Do you know who Representative Garofalo is?
Madam Chair,
Representative Johnson.
I said I don't know anybody at ALEC. I didn't say I don't know any Minnesota legislators. I'm talking about there is an organization called ALEC that has a staff, and that was my comment, not about anybody in Minnesota who may attend ALEC meetings. Do legislators go to ALEC from around the country? They do. I don't. I don't go to ALEC meetings, so I don't know anybody there, so I did not say that I don't know anybody who goes to an ALEC meeting.
So two things. I think when you have a state chair of an organization, you can pretty much assume that that person is a part of the organization. And I'm curious, does your organization have people that attend ALEC meetings?
Representative Johnson.
Representative, no.
Representative Dean. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Joel Carlson is our final witness today, but at least that I know of. It's on the calendar here. So. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Oh, and before you get started,
yes, ma'am.
This is a good reminder to me to remind all the people around this table that Friday is Law School for Legislators at William Mitchell College beginning at 9 o'clock. We have a full agenda. I'll be speaking a little bit more about it on the House floor, but Mr. Carlson helps every year in getting that arranged for legislators, and we're greatly appreciative. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And the legislation before you, I think, is probably one of the most unfair pieces of legislation that you'll vote on this year. With a brief little slip of my past serving in this chamber, I was a legislator in 1986 when we first mandated that people wear their seatbelts, and I voted for it, which was controversial at the time because many people at the time felt it was my personal freedom to decide whether or not I wanted to wear that seatbelt, and many people still have that feeling today. Seatbelt usage in 1986 was at 33%. Today we're at, as has been noted, we're at 94%, and women, you do much better. Women are belted up at a rate of 98%. But we must agree, while seatbelts are important and people use them and they save lives, we must also agree that seatbelt use or non-use does not cause an accident. And this legislation in front of you punishes good drivers, it punishes children, passengers, and those that exercise their freedom not to wear a seatbelt for the sole benefit of bad drivers and their insurance companies. This is really the Drunken Distracted Driver Protection Act. And I don't say that lightly because it really is. You have to look at what this does. So if you're using the seatbelt evidence to blame someone who has done nothing wrong to cause an accident, they've done nothing wrong, that is the height of injustice. Minnesota should continue to keep this rule in place that's been the law for 54 years, and we should keep it in place. And to give you an idea of how big an issue this is for your constituents, let's talk a little bit about crash facts. There are over 75,000 reported motor vehicle accidents in Minnesota every year. Over 138,000 vehicles are involved, and over 182,000 Minnesotans. 30,000 people in Minnesota received some type of injury in Minnesota. And in 2015, when the last crash facts report came out, 411 people lost their lives. 3,634 of those crashes were alcohol-related, and over 2,200 injuries were caused by impaired drivers. When officers report on their accident report what the contributing factors are, they look at distracted driving, they look at speed, weather conditions, chemical use, tailgating. Not a single report says that the failure to wear a seatbelt caused a motor vehicle accident, not a single one. So imagine a situation where a family member, a teenager, a child, an elderly person is rear-ended or run over by a drunk driver or a distracted driver. In every single case, not in the one case where you're not wearing it, this evidence will be used in every single case to reduce the amount of money that is paid to your constituents when they're injured. Because I would encourage you to flip House File 251 over and read what is being repealed. Because it isn't just seatbelts. It's child restraint. It's not just seatbelts. So, if you think that it won't happen, what Representative Lesch has talked about, where they will argue in their case in chief that you are at fault for your own injuries, you need to look at states that have it, and most of them don't. I can answer this. 30 states exclude this evidence completely. There are 12 states that allow it in some fashion. Florida, New Jersey, and New York are three of the worst because it goes to causation. It goes in your case in chief. And that is the worst result. I can show you a case that was just decided in 2015 in Florida where a person was parked, was rear-ended by an off-duty police officer, ejected from the car. He was in jail at the time of trial when the case came to trial for vehicular homicide. And they argued that that person who died was at fault for their own injuries because they weren't belted. And the jury came back and they found 70% fault on behalf of the injured party. And everyone here knows that when you have that level of fault on the injured party who didn't cause the accident, you recover nothing. That is exactly what this case is about. You know, I handed around a picture of a limousine bus that was in an accident in 2015 on the New Jersey Turnpike. Comedian Tracy Morgan was run over by an 80,000-pound 18-wheeler. Four people seriously injured and hospitalized, including Tracy Morgan. One person, comedian Jimmy Mack, died in that accident. And what is the response? Flip it over. Walmart blames the passengers for their own injuries because they weren't belted in that bus. Now, we've all got on a bus like that, whether we're at a convention, a conference, or something else. We don't put our seatbelts on. We don't always put them on. Maybe some do. I know I personally don't, and I wear them all the time. What they're saying is in that instance, with those kinds of injuries, those passengers were to blame for an accident that was caused by a driver who hadn't slept in 24 hours, who was on the road for 13 and a half hours, who was traveling 20 miles an hour over the speed limit and fell asleep, causing a multi-car pileup. Those passengers in that vehicle are responsible for their own injuries, according to the insurance company for Walmart. That is unfair. You know, whether it's a teenager who's unbuckled, whether it's despite your best efforts, you have a child in the back seat, or grandpa and grandma don't buckle them in quite properly, they're now responsible for their own injuries under this bill. If you live in farm country, and I spend a lot of time out there, if you're leaving the farm field at night to get home and you're head-on collision with a drunk driver on your way to your house, you're now at fault for your own injury because you didn't put that belt on. Each of these instances, members, are, you can imagine them, you can see them. Gene Johnson in St. Cloud was hit by a distracted driver who T-boned her at 60 miles an hour. 60 miles an hour. She still is recovering from her injuries. Not wearing a seatbelt, her fault. The distracted driver killed himself in that accident. Two Bloomington snowplow operators not too long ago, Representative Carlson, hit by a driver going over 100 miles an hour, intoxicated and on a death wish. It's their fault. This is unfair. I wanted to show you a video clip, but I didn't have the right hookup, Madam Chair, of a driver, truck driver, John Chess, who was arrested in July of just 2016 on Highway 10 in Morrison County. He was so intoxicated at 2.8 driving a semi-trailer truck that he fell out of the truck when the officer pulled him over. They had to close the highway to get him off the highway. They had to shut it down. You're telling your constituents that if that driver hits you in that truck and for whatever reason your child is not buckled, they get out, they're going to be held accountable for their own fault for these damages. Madam Chair and members, this law has been in place for 54 years and it's based on sound public policy. You know, and people say it was because of contributory negligence. And that's why the legislature did that. And there may be a little kernel of truth there. But let's look at the case law and let's look at what happened. The legislature adopted a mandate in 1963 that auto manufacturers install seatbelts in automobiles. And at that time, it was very questionable whether or not they actually enhanced your injuries or a safety device. That was an actual debate. We know that that has long since passed. But Minnesota Supreme Court long held until the legislature overruled them that this seatbelt gag rule was put in place logically to protect manufacturers who were being imposed upon by the legislature to install seatbelts when we didn't know if they were actually going to work. And in Olson versus Ford Motor Company in 1997, the Supreme Court came to that very conclusion. The legislature's ban on evidence of using seatbelts, the seatbelt gag rule, might logically have been designed to shield manufacturers from lawsuits should state-mandated seatbelts ultimately result in injuries to motorists. That's what our court said all the way until 1999, when this legislature allowed for crashworthiness claims to go forward. So for 36 years, these same insurance companies used the seatbelt gag rule as a shield to protect themselves from liability. Now they want to use it as a sword against your constituents, and it will come up in every single case. And what will happen is, it's use or non-use, remember? Your injuries can be enhanced by the seatbelt. And is that your fault? Let's say you have, Representative Lunan's example, you've got $100,000 worth of damage to you or your family or your child, and they're going to say, maybe 20% on you. And these cases don't go to trial. Representative Hillstrom, 2,676 cases, personal injury cases filed in Minnesota courts in 2015. Very few of them go to jury. So where this is going to come into play is not in trial. It's going to come into play when they go to settle your case. And they're not going to pay you full value on your case. They're going to reduce that because we're going to allege or say you weren't wearing your seatbelt. Almost everybody takes it off when they get out of the car. How am I going to prove I was wearing it? It's going to come up in every single case. Madam Chair and members, this legislation is sound. They don't allow this evidence in most jurisdictions because it increases the complexity of cases. It produces these horrible, harsh results. And it's just simply unfair. The cost and length of trial is greatly expanded because this evidence has to be proven by expert medical testimony. So that means the plaintiff has to hire an expert, has to hire a doctor to prove what the injuries were or would not have been relative to the seatbelt use. That is absolutely wrong. And this issue, whether they do it in their case in chief, or I would argue even if they do it on damages, it's unfair to your constituents because not wearing that belt never caused the accident. It should never be used for causation. And if they want to use it as mitigation in damages, I have to ask you, how can you mitigate a damage that hasn't occurred? The damage hasn't occurred yet. Well, I'm going to put it on after the fact. Mitigation of damages is what you do after the injury occurs. That simply doesn't apply here. So I urge caution, members. This is a very significant windfall. It will produce harsh and hard results on your constituents, and it's not just a couple. 75,000 accidents a year. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to answer questions.
Any questions for this testifier? Thank you, Mr. Carlson, for your testimony. Representative Looning?
Madam Chair, I wanted to request a roll call.
Sure. A roll call has been requested. Representative Looning, any quick final comments?
Yes, members. The purpose of this bill is to acknowledge the fact in a civil proceeding that wearing or failing to wear a seatbelt is a factor in how injured you become. And if you agree with the data that shows wearing seatbelts makes you safer in a car than not wearing seatbelts, and that wearing a seatbelt, not wearing a seatbelt is a decision of that individual, and that they should be accountable for that decision, then I ask you to vote for the provision.
Thank you. Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 251 is recommended to be re-referred to Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Lesh?
No.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Howe?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Lunan?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Omar?
No.
Representative O'Neill?
Aye.
Representative Pugh?
Aye.
Representative Vogel?
Aye.
Representative Whalen?
Aye.
The vote is 9-6. The motion prevails.
Representative Scott, House File 291, do you care to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 291, Mr. Chair.
All right, to your bill.
Members, this November, Star Tribune reporter came upon some information that the suites at the new U.S. Bank Stadium during some of the football games and events there, that many of the participants that came and occupied those suites were friends and family members, and that there was some dispute then whether or not those lists should be made public of the people that were attending the suites, that were present in the suites during football games and other events. And so what this bill seeks to do is just clarify whether or not those seat lists are public. And with that, I guess I would just offer the bill. And by the way, it does say that those lists should be public if the participants were receiving free or discounted admission tickets or other gifts from this publicly owned stadium.
Do you have any testifiers?
I believe there's one testifier here.
Hello, please state your name to the for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. Our organization supports the clarity that this bill seeks to bring to HF 1355. That's the section that classifies convention center data. I'll talk a little bit about why clarity is useful later on, but I want to talk about the history of the statute first. You'll see a packet from us that has the modifications over time that have been made to the statute starting in 1982 up through 2005 was the last time there were modifications. And you'll see that the statute has always had at its core classifying data relating to the leasing or rental of convention center facilities, starting with the St. Paul Civic Center. So that's been the core function of the statute from the beginning. And it seeks to classify certain information such as the identity of firms or corporations that contact their facilities and the terms of rentals. Now, setting aside whether that was good public policy or not at the beginning, that is the and always has been the identity or the original intent of this statute. What's not classified here in a generalized way is whether people have been given free or discounted admission or tickets in any kind of generalized way. That's presumptively public data. So we would welcome clarification to that being put into the statute. And the reason why is that if you look at the controversy that's come up around the MSFA and look at the history of that controversy, first the Star Tribune asked the MSFA for the guest lists. And they were rebuffed. They were rejected. And they were told that 1355 covered all of the guest list. Then they went back and challenged it, and they were given 99% of the names. And on the list I've seen, just two names were withheld for folks that were talking to MSFA for potential future rental purposes. So even though that stuff is public data, there is a history within the Amendments for the Data Practices Act to if there have been controversies or misinterpretations of the law to then go back and clarify. So what this would do would be to do that kind of clarification. And you can see this in other parts of the statute. If you, on the back page of our packet in statute 13601, there's both call-outs for not public data and then clarifications for what data sets are public within that general not public classification. So this has been done from time to time to add clarity, and we would welcome that clarity being brought to 1355. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Lesch. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ehling, I'm not sure I totally understood what the MSFA's justification was for denying in the first place. You had alluded to the fact that 1355 covered everything. Can you re-clarify that? Because I didn't understand it.
Oh, sure. If you look at some of the data elements that are covered by 1355, there's a couple different subsections. The first subsection talks about the identity of firms and corporations which contact the facility, the types of events they wish to stage, suggested terms of rentals, and then there's other sections that deal with other kinds of communications around rentals of facilities.
Okay.
And so the MSFA initially said, we can't release any names because of this. Then they eventually released most of the names, with the exception of two that they identified as being for future rental purposes.
The data set that we had designated originally under that was not broad enough under their interpretation. Is that fair to say?
Mr. Ehling. My read of what they tried to do was they tried to read the statute too broadly, and that's where we think clarification is useful.
Representative Lesch. All right, no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and question for the testifier. So you had mentioned that of all the lists of names for the past incident have been released with the exception of two, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, and
Representative Lucero.
Mr. Chair, Scott, is it your understanding that they intend to release those two additional names at any point in the future?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe they're saying that those names will not be released because they were there for marketing purposes.
Okay.
Representative Lucero.
So my understanding then of the discussion that just took place, the testimony, and Representative Lesch was that they were reading too broad, and that even under current language, which the bill seeks to clarify, that those names should be released and should not be withheld. Is that my understanding? And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it's Section 1 lays out, Subdivision 1 of 1355 lays out carve-outs for when the names on that list would not be made public. And if those people were there kind of for official business, for that they're thinking of renting the facility, U.S. Bank Stadium, or any of these other facilities that are publicly owned, if they're thinking of renting those names would not be released.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one more question then. So if that's the case, and I'm not even sure what the totality of the number of names that was released, if it can be by deductive reasoning and that the two were withheld, if that means that they were there for official purposes, can I conclude then that all the names that were released had nothing to do with marketing or official purposes?
Representative Scott?
Yes. Mr. Chair, yes, I think you can conclude that.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want some clarification. I think that the information should be public. I have no concern with that. I want clarification about how much is actually going to be public. So if someone is granted a discount, so if Carlson Company comes in and is going to rent a bunch of suites over time, or another Target is going to rent a bunch of suites over time, and therefore they are given a discount for their consistent use, then would that list also become public, or is there another exception under these other lists of exceptions? Because I want to make sure that if folks are getting things for a discount or for free, that if we're going to have public information, we should have public information.
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My understanding is, yes, that would be made public. If they are getting a discount according to this correction of the bill language, that information would be public.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then just that company got it, or the list of everybody that attended on behalf of that company because they got discounted tickets?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to defer to House Research to answer that question, because that's a very good question.
Mr. Hopkins?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hillstrom, the bill states that data regarding persons receiving free or discounted admissions, and persons can mean companies or it can mean particular individuals. So I'm not sure if the language of the bill on its face provides a clear answer to your question, but persons could mean individuals and it could mean companies.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is in the event a member maybe works for a company or in the event a member attends with a company, I want to know if that's going to be public, because at the time there was the controversy about who was in those suites. There were photographs of other members sitting on the sidelines. There were photographs of other members in different suites. And I'm just trying to figure out if we're going to get the names of everybody.
Representative Scott.
That is my intent. And so if we need to tighten that language and put individuals or persons, that would probably do it, Mr. Ealing. Would you agree with that, or staff?
I think there's two options for further amendments to clarify the language. One is that you could strike everything starting on 1.5. The sentence, or the partial sentence, it says unless the data are subject to the provisions of subdivision 1. So that would make all information about anybody that got discounted anything public. So that's one option. If folks want to keep to the history of the statute, you could make another very narrow change, which would say unless the data reveals the identity of a firm or corporation classified by subdivision 1B. So that would tie it to that original data element that just talks about the identity of firms or corporations. So that would further narrow the possible universe of information. So either one of those could be done to clarify, depending on what you folks want to do. Representative Hillstrom?
I just want a clarification of what she's trying to do, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Scott.
Thank you. My intention is to make as much public as possible. So if there are representatives of a corporation there that receive free or discounted tickets, those names should be made public, in my opinion.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott. So I'm looking at this, and this is so broad.
I'm sorry?
I'm looking at this, and this seems so broad. I mean, I'm thinking about the people that run convention centers in Duluth, in St. Cloud, in Rochester, in Moorhead, and civic centers throughout the state. We're now asking their administration to make sure that anybody who gets a discount, that anybody who gets free admission or tickets or things like that as gifts, and I don't know if this even goes so far as if I participate or someone participates in a raffle and receives tickets to an event that's at a public owned facility. I mean, it seems so broad. I get really sort of fearful because the cost that we're going to incur on these people to maintain that data in the event that an inquiry is brought forward is pretty extreme. And I think I understand what you're trying to do. I mean, you're trying to get really the Sports Facility Authority and other like agencies in the state to really be on the up and up about what they're doing, and you're doing it from their side. And I think we all, as elected officials or individuals, we actually have an obligation on our side not to accept gifts, not to accept discounts, not to accept things like that. So really, I think what your bill is as much about holding them accountable. It's sort of telling us that we don't have to be accountable unless someone finds out or someone else is being in charge of that. And then I just want to add one more thing, and it's just a question. So I occasionally go to conventions at facilities that are owned by the city of Minneapolis, and sometimes there's early bird discounts for registering before a certain date. So would that be something that would be disclosed as well? I'm just curious.
Mr. Ealing? Representative Dean, yes, all of that information would be publicly available. And just to give you some background on how the Data Practices Act works, is it does have a presumption that all government data are public unless the legislature specifically delineates specific information as not public for a particular reason. And so the idea that I think that there will be additional burden placed on the facility if more data is made public, I would disagree with that just because they already have the statute that exists that makes a wide variety of data public. And this is not a bigger subset, I would argue. Representative.
So sort of two things. I hope that when I do an early bird registration for a discount, it actually says early bird registration discount and not just a discount, because I don't want to go up before the Ethics Committee regarding that. And if it already does it, then what are we doing here?
Mr. Ealing. Representative Dina, this is very specifically trying to get to the controversy of MSFA not releasing or at least attempting not to release already public data. And so there has been historical precedent throughout the years of amending the Data Practices Act where there's been a controversy. This was done a couple years ago, for instance. So there was a controversy over whether the BCA would release information about Stingray cell phone tracking device. And the existence of that device at BCA is presumptively public, so they have to release it. The fact that they own it, they had to release. But they really resisted it, had to go through IPAD to get an opinion. The legislature later on clarified the law enforcement data section to say that the existence of that stuff is public. So this attempts to fix a similar kind of problem.
So, Representative Dean. So, Mr. Chair, I would just... As I'm looking at this, I think I understand the goal, and I agree that the Minnesota Sports Facility Authority shouldn't be withholding this information. It shouldn't be a chore to get that information. But I just don't understand why we're including all convention facilities, all civic centers. And the thing that I would also want to ask, it says data regarding persons. I'm assuming that's data specific to this. We're not releasing phone numbers. We're not releasing addresses. We're not releasing all data regarding these individuals.
Mr. Ealing? Representative Dean, all of that information is already presumptively public, with the exception of what's in Subdivision 1. So, again, the identity of a firm that contacts the MSFA, for instance, is withheld.
Representative Howe? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I've got two questions now. I only had one before, but I would have to believe that any discount that's available to the general public is probably not concerning this data set, correct? If you get an early bird discount, that's open to the public. We're not concerned with that data. Is that correct?
Mr. Ealing? If the MSFA is administering ticket prices, and I don't know exactly their practices, but if that public facility is setting the ticket prices and the discounts, that information would be public.
Representative Howe.
All right. The other question I have is I'm a little concerned because I own a business, I own a company. If I go to this organization and decide I want to rent that and have a discussion about renting and go to the place, then my stuff is withheld just because I'm going there as a company, not as a gift as a member?
Mr. Ealing. Representative Howe, that's how the statute currently reads. Mm-hmm. Again, to back up, if I was sitting here in 1982, I would argue against that because it's a public facility. But my understanding, the intent of this bill is to clarify what's already in law to ensure that the maximum amount of public information is released. So that's what this is trying to get at.
Representative Howe?
Well, thank you, but I don't know why we withhold that information either, but that's fine.
And we have four more questions and 10 minutes left, so if we could be brief, that would be appreciated. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, Representative Scott, I wonder if you entertain a friendly amendment.
Perhaps. Representative Scott?
Perhaps.
Representative Lesh.
I'm looking for on line 1.15 to strike R in both locations and insert is.
Representative Scott?
I think I would find that as a friendly amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Scott. The consistent use of R, Mr. Ealing, is like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. It's like Superman and Kryptonite. I just can't handle it. So thank you very much, Representative Scott. Ms. Christensen's presence here notwithstanding. She's a big fan of the R.
I know.
And I would note also, Mr. Ealing, that when you use the word information, you said is as a singular, but when you said data, you said R. And justification for most people I talk to say that because data in its Latin version was in the plural.
Yes.
Huh?
Huh?
I know that, but I'm kind of pontificating.
Representative Lesh?
I got to pontificate. But I would just note simply, Mr. Chair,
you have questions.
That information or informatio is a Latin root also. Okay, I'm done.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Johnson.
But I did have a question.
Representative Lesh.
A real question. Briefly, please. Okay, thank you. So, admission. Is everyone who's admitted to a facility like this, is that so, let's say someone who was there to do a job, sing the national anthem or something. I mean, I think Peggy Flanagan sang the national anthem at a Twins game or something, as I recall. Are we intended to include those people if they're in and out?
Mr. Ealing.
If there's a record of that information, say they have a record, like this would cover the deck, for instance. Say the deck up in Duluth wanted to hire somebody to come sing the national anthem,
yeah.
And they have records that say who that is. That would be public information and would fall outside of this particular statute. It would be presumptively public.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And briefly, Representative Scott, if a legislator, I guess anybody else, was invited to a corporate suite where a regular person wasn't typically allowed to go to, and had that opportunity, would that be part of the data that be available?
Mr. Ealing.
Yes, that would be public information.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, we're talking here specifically about the suites that the Sports Authority, the MSFA, they control these two suites. And so we're saying that those lists are the ones that would be made public. If a corporation owns a suite, my understanding is that they don't have to release who their guests are at any given event. Is that what you're getting at?
Representative Johnson?
Well, that's unless they got
it. Well, if someone's getting a special deal at one of these events, my understanding is you want to make sure that data is available. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I getting it?
Mr. Ealing.
What your intent is here?
To clarify, this would apply to publicly owned facilities, so mm-hmm. the publicly managed known boxes that MSFA controls, or say, you know, even the Burnsville Arts Center, if they're giving discounted admission, all of that would be public data, and it already is public data, but this clarifies that it remains public data.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was a quick follow-up to Representative Dean's questioning, but I think Representative Howell touched on that, and that is I think the focus of this effort is to bring sunlight into access that the general public does not have, rather than the early bird discounts that everybody would have available to them. And so, but again, it was touched on already by Representative House. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if nonpartisan staff could actually go through what, because it says in the new statute or the new language that it's the data is subject except for under the provisions under subdivision 1, and I'm wondering if they could go through, since Subdivision 1 isn't included in this language, what the Subdivision 1 exclusions include?
Mr. Hopkins.
Because that seems to be the question that we've asked a million times, and maybe they could just clarify.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair and members, Subdivision 1 of 13.5 provides that, generally speaking, data which pertain to an ongoing negotiation for rental of a facility will be non-public. The reason for that is that if Billy Joel is looking to rent a publicly owned and operated stadium, the facility might not want the negotiations to be public so that another facility or institution could be aware of exactly what kind of prices they're charging and come in just under their quotes. So Subdivision 1 says it lists some specific information that would be non-public. Subparagraph A says a letter or other documentation from any person who makes an inquiry to or who is contacted by the facility regarding the availability of the facility for staging events. B is the identity of firms and corporations which contact the facility. C is the type of event which they want to stage in the facility. D is the suggested terms of rentals. And E is the responses of authority staff to those inquiries. So generally speaking, we're talking about data or information that the entity maintains as part of a negotiation for rental of the facilities. Now, under Subdivision 2 of 13.55, those data aren't not public forever. Subdivision 2 provides that after 5 years from the date on which the contract for rental, after 5 years of, from that date, the data become public. Also, if the contract doesn't actually occur and there is no rental contract signed, the event which was the subject of the inquiry, the proposed date for that event, after that happens, the data would become public. And under C, if the event which was the subject of the inquiry or the negotiations, if it occurs elsewhere, then, of course, the negotiations are over, they've terminated, and the data regarding the negotiations would become public. So the data that are made not public under Subdivision 1 of 13.5 aren't not public forever.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Hopefully that clarifies what is and what is not under this.
Yeah. And as a reminder, this bill is going to state gov finance, and the author is amenable to making any changes or recommendations. A closing, a brief comment, Representative Dean?
Just to clarify in response to Representative Lucerno's comment, I think you're right. I don't think that that's the intent of this, but I think it's written so broadly that it would encompass me getting an early bird discount, and I would hope that the author, before this moves forward, would begin to sort of parse out some of those specific things relative to this bill.
Representative Scott, closing comments?
I just appreciate your support on the bill. We'll tweak the language as needed, and I just want to clarify what Representative Johnson's question was. I know he's left now, but I think what he was getting at is if there's a corporate suite and you're invited to the corporate suite as a legislator by that corporation, that is not public data. That suite is not the same thing as the publicly controlled suites that we're talking about here in this bill. That clarifies.
Representative Hillstrom, a closing brief comment?
Just to that point, I think the way it's drafted, if that corporate suite got a discount, I think it would be subject. And so I think we need to look at the data.
Representative Scott?
Very fine.
With that, Representative Scott renews her motion. House File 291, be re-referred to the State Gov Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion carries. And this meeting is adjourned.